Brooks. I study at Clark University in Massachusetts, the United States. I am so incredibly excited and honored to be here today and to be following such fantastic presentations. I also want to apologize because I wrote a paper, so I'm going to read it. It might not be as engaging as all these the wonderful presentations that we just got, but hopefully the question and answers will be a little more engaging. So my research focuses on prison transfers, and that was a topic that I was drawn to having listened to the ways that we, especially Americans, rhetorically construct mass incarceration. When people talk about mass incarceration, they often talk as if those entangled with the prison system just disappear, that people are warehoused and immobilized somewhere over there. And I came to this project really interested in troubling the idea that prison happens over there, and that it's only and always about holding people still. In my research, I found that the geographies of incarceration, as many people in this room will know, are as much about movement as fixity, as much about isolation as porousness, and as much about encounter as fragmentation. So when people go to prison, they don't just go to one place. Instead, they are often transferred within a network of facilities during their time inside. In my research, I asked, how do transfers constitute and complicate the carceral? How do they work upon people enmeshed in the vast carceral system, and how do those people negotiate and resist them? So I've conducted a mixed method study, which included talking to people who were previously incarcerated, lawyers, and activists about transfers. I also obtained data from several different Department of Corrections, a process which itself was replete with concealment and with bureaucratic barriers. And then finally, I took an ethnographic bus trip with people who were visiting their incarcerated loved ones. And so in this presentation, I want to talk about how transfers move subjects who are made unhuman across vast amounts of space, and how their logistics are lived on the bodies of those moved. We're going to engage with work in critical logistics and in carceral temporalities, so thinking about time again, to parse out why transfers happen, why transfers really happen, and how those logistics, how their logics are inherently contrived, political, and embodied. So I came to logistics, I was interested in logistics as systems that manage and calibrate time and space in order to move goods, stuff, from producers to consumers. So Deborah Cohen's fantastic book, The Deadly Life of Logistics, offers language to think about logistical systems as ideological and technological and material. So these are systems that organize the movement of things by arranging labor, transport technology, laws, and consumption so that in its ideal, things can be produced, moved, and consumed without any friction. In other words, so that products can move fluidly across space and just in time. So as such, the technical charts and graphs that sort of comprise the logistical systems appear apolitical and contained, pertaining only to the process of getting a container of goods from over there to here. Yet in her book, Cohen shows how logistics are never apolitical. This is in her own words. She says she elaborates on the profoundly political life of forms of knowledge and calculation that present themselves as purely technical. So I was really interested in that, and I asked, what would it look like to chart Cohen's criticism of the mobilization of goods and capital onto my criticism of the mobilization of people through the prison system? How is it that we can map the circulation of people in order to understand that movement as fundamentally contested? So I argue that engaging with critical logistics draws our attention to three key workings of transfers. Firstly, that the transfer system connects prisons so that they are never isolated spaces. So as Cohen writes, logistics, quote, implies that the site is never simply local or entirely contained. Logistics shifts our focus from the individual prison to the carceral system as a network of sites that people, goods, and information move between. Secondly, I think that logistics shows us how transfers do political work. And so when I describe transfers as political, what I mean is that instead of being sort of natural, normal, or inherent, transfers have been constructed and are daily reproduced by the state in order to do something specific, to do specific work. Thus, underlying their official and often technical causes, transfers are targeted and violent. In particular, transfers operate to produce specific subjectivity, to make people unhuman. And then finally, time is a really central axis of logistical systems. So in this way, logistics points us towards considering the temporality of transfers. Transfers comprise a mundane movement within the prison system. So for the most part, they're considered kind of a non-event. In being so, however, they're really significant. They add up. So on June 27th, 2018, a random date, the state of Mississippi moved 84 people around 12,000 miles between prisons. In just 5 days in one working week, that's pictured geographically in this map here, Mississippi moved 293 people between prisons. If we were to multiply those moves over the course of a year, that comes to 21,389 moves in a year. Cohen writes about mapping circulation in order to understand the interconnections within logistics space. So in this case, by mapping the circulation, we can see kind of the carceral web within Mississippi. This map shows the chaotic tendrils of the carceral state, which reach and twist and crisscross. As such, we can see that the transfer system in this state, but also in many others, I would say in all of them, is a chaotic and constant network of movement. Logistics also calls our attention to the politicized nature of these technocratic assemblages. So in the case of transfers, the official logics of why and when they happen are often portrayed as apolitical. By this I mean that the logics of transfers sort of paper over the ways that they're contested and the ways that if we think about that contestation, the ways that they sort of invite alternative futures. So officially, transfers are often used as a disciplinary measure. That's the first point here, a sort of movement as punishment. So most obviously, if someone's in a fight, all of the parties involved will be transferred to different facilities. But they can also result, even still as a disciplinary transfer, they can result from an accumulation of minor infractions. So for example, one woman I spoke to, she described racking up enough disciplinary tickets from having a broken arm of her glasses and then a misbuttoned shirt one too many times. So in this way, transfers are argued to be sort of the natural result of accumulating, say, 90 ticket points. Transfers can also be focused, this is the second point here, on the well-being, which is always calibrated in particular ways, of people who are incarcerated. So for example, if someone is really ill, if there's severe safety concerns for that person, or if they're reclassified to a more or less secure status, they'll often be moved. And then finally, the third point down, people can also request transfers. So in New York State, people who are incarcerated, they'll ask their counselors or a different prison official to fill in this top form here, which is then reviewed by the central office and potentially accepted, and that's that bottom form. It's pretty hard to read them because they have this classified mark on those, but that's from the New York State Department of Corrections. So underlying these sort of official logics, there are other reasons that people get transferred. So for example, the people that I spoke to were transferred for, in their words, getting too comfortable at a particular facility. This meant everything from excelling and finding joy in a particular job to creating a community within prison or to being in a relationship. So to be clear, nobody that I spoke to argued that their time inside was good or comfortable, but often transfers explicitly undermined their ability to survive. In the words of one woman I spoke to, she wasn't, quote, necessarily getting comfortable, that is, in prison, but making a way of life, making a routine for yourself. People were also transferred as a result of bigotry. I spoke to several trans women who felt or were told explicitly that they were transferred because they were trans. And then finally, and this is what I really want to focus on for the rest of the presentation, people are often transferred to fill space in other facilities or to open up space in their facility. And you can sort of see this in the way that the transfer system is experienced. So when the Legislative Commission of Expenditure Review, that's the LCER, when they reviewed New York State's transfer process in 1991, they found that, and this is in their words, inmate moves are primarily intended to meet the system's, not the inmate's needs. These needs, first and foremost, are to, once again in their words, attempt to fill every bed every day. In other words, transfers facilitate the prison system's flow of people to make that system as frictionless as possible and that movement as frictionless as possible. At the same time that the transfer system props up an efficient prison housing scheme, it also aims for internal efficiency. So in the words of many people I spoke to, the transfer buses are often filled as much as possible, and as you can see here, as much as possible, if not just to justify the trip, to make it worth it. So in this way, the official logics of transfers obscure deeper ones, in particular that the prison state requires channeled, frictionless, constant movement to stay full and efficient. So I think that there's an eerie resonance between the logistical supply chain up there and the charts and the maps of the transfer process. They're similar goals. Maximization, efficiency, collapse of space-time, frictionlessness. The similar goals between the two highlight how transfers seek to produce unhuman subjects. They're objectifying. Luca Follis writes about how viewing prisons as networks allows us to see how prisoners become, quote, bundles of favorable characteristics and cross-sections of risk that make them suitable for transfer. So transfers turn people into constructed statistical objects and then move them as such. Trevor Ellison, who is an absolutely brilliant scholar, they describe how black bodies are made invisible in the ways that they are placed outside of the category of human. So I argue that transfers attempt to render people, often and especially young black men, unhuman and invisible. So people that I spoke to compared the transfer process to the movement of cattle, the good. They described being humiliated, poked and prodded, and shackled uncomfortably. They described being seen and treated like animals or objects. And so while transfers are shrouded in an apolitical process, an assemblage of risk scores and bed shortages and disciplinary points, in reality they were embodied, they were lived as producing this non-human subjectivity. And then I think, of course, if we're thinking through critical logistics, I would really say that that urges us to question how the creation of an unhuman prisoner subject is in fact itself a political project that props up the carceral system as natural and normal and necessary and fair. So, a bit of a pivot, and I'll try to be fast because we're out of time. At the same time that supply chains reflect transfer routes, they also diverge in their different attentions to time. So whereas logistics functions on just-in-time ideology, attempting to kind of squelch space-time down to oblivion, the criminal justice system operates to weaponize time, so that people who are incarcerated have to do time, where time is an action. So I'm drawing here from the wonderful work of Jackie Wang, who has spoken about carceral temporalities as weaponry, especially in the forced detemporalization of solitary confinement. Simone Brown as well, who's also brilliant, she writes about this character who was held in solitary confinement in fluorescent lighting 24 hours a day, and who describes himself as living neither in daytime nor in nighttime, but in no time. No time pervades transfers in the ways that they stretch to fill hours and days. So the role of time and waiting in transfers was mentioned by many of the people that I spoke to. People recounted 5, 8, 10, and 12-hour bus rides. Lamar, for example, said, quote, you know, these officers are not in a rush to get to their location because it's overtime for them. The longer they're on the road, the more hours they can log. So this time spent in motion is often uncomfortable, with people shackled usually at their ankles and their wrists and their waists, and often in really painful contortions. It's time that's often spent without food, bathrooms, or air conditioning, and while sitting on unpadded seats. And the drive is only part of what takes time in a transfer. As you can see in this very rough timeline, sort of a typical transfer, many people describe being held in a holding pen, where they would wait to be security checked and processed out of the facility, and then again upon arriving, held in another holding pen where they would be security checked once again and then processed into a facility. So one person told me that he's waited up to 12 hours after having driven for 5 to 8 before being processed, and that was a really common experience that came up again and again. So I want to ask really quickly, what is the relationship between no time and just in time? The temporality of transfers highlights some of the work that they do. So as Lamar is arguing, the use of time stems in part from the block of correctional workers who want to extend their overtime as long as possible. Like the police, correctional officers often inflate their paychecks exponentially based on overtime. So for example, and there's so many examples of this, but in Wisconsin, prison overtime cost the state $42 million in 2017. So in this way, the prison transfer is one tool by which prisons fix state crisis, stacking the sacrifice of human time spent uncomfortably against the paychecks of correctional officers. And then returning again to Wang, the temporality of transfers resonates with the broader use of time as punishment in the carceral system. So I believe that transfers aren't just slow to pad the pockets of correctional officers, but also to reinforce the sort of embodied punitiveness of the carceral state. So logistics allows us to see how the logics of transfers connect prisons into a network, how they're always already political, and how they attempt to produce these unhuman subjects. And at the same time, they also, for thinking about critical logistics, draws our attention to the different role of time in the carceral as in movements of goods and capital. But beyond what logistics allows us to see, how can it help us then to take apart? So Ruth Gilmore, she argues that the goal of abolition geography is not just to identify weaknesses within the carceral system, but also to unearth its inherent contradictions. And so I see that even as the transfer system views people as objects, it is actively resisted in the ways that people being moved look back to kind of gesture towards bell hooks and gaze out of prison bus windows. So really, despite the discomfort and fear and confusion often associated with being transferred, the moving process also means getting a chance to look at the outside in a way that's often denied to people in prison. So people that I spoke to describe transfers as a chance to see everything from grass and farms to the types of cars that people are driving. They described looking at people on the outside as they drove past and imagining a future when they would no longer be encaged. And they described gazing out, in short, not as objects to be moved, but as people seeking connections beyond prison walls. One person's words in particular really struck me. Sean describes how the sky looks different to him outside of prison. And so he remembers looking out at the sky and at the sun during transfers and getting to see for a moment like he wasn't incarcerated. And so one way that the critical logistics of transfers can help us, to quote Angela Davis, a movement elder and prison abolitionist, turn walls sideways into bridges, is to see not only its weaknesses, but also its fundamental contradiction, that the people who are moved, they resist the gaze of the state, which seeks to make them unhuman, by looking back and looking out. Thank you.